May I speak in the name of God, who is lover, beloved, and love sharer.
Amen.
Amen. 2 weeks ago, I reflected on the text for the second Sunday after Epiphany, and I found my attention somewhat reluctantly returning to St. Paul's words in the epistle reading on that Sunday from 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Today, on the fourth Sunday after Epiphany, I find my attention drawn yet again to the continuing argument Paul makes concerning freedom. The gist of his developing argument continually throws up examples in the life of the community that highlights the tension between law and grace. And in chapter 8 that we heard this morning, his example concerns the hot-button issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols. Now, context is everything. Well, almost. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, unadulterated Paul is often a tough sell for 21st century ears. The ancient Greek city of Corinth, like its modern-day counterpart, occupied a strategic position situated on the Isthmus of Corinth, a narrow neck of land between the Aegean and the Adriatic seas, that provided a narrow land bridge connecting mainland Greece with the Peloponnese Peninsula. The significance of ancient Corinth lay in its equidistance between the two regional powers of Sparta and Athens. And in counterbalancing both the political and the military power of these two great rivals, Corinth played a key role within the organization of Greek city-states known as the Achaean League. Corinth controlled not only the east-west axis route between Sparta and Athens, but commanded the harbors on the Aegean and the Adriatic sides of the isthmus. And thus it controlled the passage of goods, unloaded in one harbor and transported the short distance across the isthmus to be reloaded in ships on the other side, thus enabling ships to avoid the longer sea journey around the Peloponnese Peninsula. Ancient Corinth was destroyed by the Romans in 146 BC during Rome's conquest of the Greek city-states. It lay in ruins for a whole century until Julius Caesar began the rebuilding of Corinth as a Roman colony for the resettlement of Rome's growing population of freed slaves, originally captured in the many campaigns in the eastern Mediterranean bordering lands. A mixed population of Syrians, Egyptians, and of course many Jews, together with numbers of Rome's poor, transformed Corinth into an economically dynamic melting pot. And with colonial status came the infusion of Roman tax revenue, triggering a huge rebuilding program of ancient Corinth's temples and civic buildings, which had lain waste for the previous century. And it was into this bustling cosmopolitan cauldron that Paul arrived sometime around the year 50-51 AD. Luke in Acts mentions that Paul traveled to Corinth, where he was joined by Silas and Timothy. And we know that Paul lodged with Aquila and his wife Priscilla, two Jewish refugees from Emperor Claudius's expulsion of the Jews from Rome during the previous decade. And like Paul, they were tent makers. There was always considerable business, from the need to constantly repair and weave new tents and awnings to protect the Corinthians from the heat of the sun. And perhaps it was noting the fevered building boom that led Paul to fashion an image for himself in Corinthians chapter 3 as a skilled master builder, laying the foundations on which others would build. Now, as a result of Jewish hostility to Paul, he left his Jewish hosts to stay with one Titius Justus, a Gentile God-fearer. Now, God-fearer was a term the Jews used for the newly converted, but often still unconverted, Gentiles who participated in the life of the synagogue. And in the face of growing Jewish resistance, Paul switches his missionary focus to the Gentile God-fearers, who, because of their attraction to and familiarity with Jewish faith and custom, were already primed to receive and to respond to his preaching of the gospel. Among the God-fearers were many wealthy women, and they exercised a great deal of power and influence. And Paul's letters reveal again and again that it was often to such women that he turned for support in the fledgling Christian communities. Now, during his first sojourn in Corinth, two significant events occurred. The first was his penning of the two letters to the Thessalonians, and the second was his arraignment before the Roman consul Gallio, brother of Seneca, at the instigation of Corinthian Jews, who brought him up on a charge of blasphemy. Gallio dismissed the case because Paul was a Roman citizen, and he declined to judge Paul on the basis of Jewish religious matters. Vindicated, Paul nevertheless must have felt that it was time to leave Corinth sometime in late 51 or early 52, and it's later in Ephesus, sometime between 53 and 54, that he pens his two letters to the Corinthians. Now, reading Paul's letters is like listening to one side of a cell phone conversation. We read his responses, but as to the questions he was posed, and the text is largely silent. Yet from what Paul writes, we can surmise that a number of serious divisions were emerging as a reflection of Corinth's rowdy and permissive cosmopolitan culture. The Corinthian church struggled with the moral issues of the right use of sex and the right attitude towards wealth. Corinthians had a reputation for sexual permissiveness. That's quite something in the Roman Empire. And they loved the conspicuous display of wealth, the latter leading to the denigration of the poor within the worship and community life of the church. Issues not unfamiliar to modern Christian communities, for human nature doesn't change much with the passage of centuries. The Corinthian church also struggled with the corruption of the notion of truth and the importance of shared values. Paul is concerned by the charismatic sway of some teachers who assailed their hearers with alternative truths, alternative facts, alternative values, rooted in baser instincts, pouring scorn on shared values of mutual respect. Yet he's particularly worried by the report of two developments in the Corinthian church. Many, it seems, were becoming vulnerable to the subtle invitation of teachers giving a Gnostic spin to the gospel message, inviting their hearers into the allure of secret knowledge. Paul has them in his sights when he writes that knowledge puffs up, whereas love builds up. And anyone who claims to know something, Paul suggests, is really admitting that they know nothing. It is through love in action, not puffed up claims to knowledge, that we become known by God, Paul tells the Corinthians. The second issue, that others were becoming susceptible to the Judaizers who demanded Gentile submission to the requirements of the law. The master builder of the gospel message, Paul, was always deeply worried by others erecting the wrong kind of building upon the foundations he had labored so hard to lay. Now, as in chapter 6, when Paul employs sexual practice to highlight the tensions between what may be lawful but not necessarily beneficial, in chapter 8, he grounds his wider development of Christian freedom in the issue of food sacrificed to idols. Now, this is not an issue for us, as far as I know. Yet, moving beyond the immediate first century contextual details, the status for Christians of the pagan temple sacrificial food offerings, can we not hear Paul addressing us today? We who live in a culture characterized by a scandalous misuse of food, from food deserts to food profligacy and waste of monumental proportions. Remember, Paul is writing in a religious context, both pagan and Jewish, where food was an integral part of religious practice. And it's here that we grasp the revolutionary nature of his words. For Paul is doing something hitherto unimaginable. He is decoupling food from religious practice. Writing prior to the first gospel, did Paul know of Jesus' teaching on this subject? In any case, he affirms Jesus' words that it's not what goes into a person that defiles, but what flows out from the heart. And so Paul tells his readers, food will not bring us close to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. And at the heart of his first Corinthian letter is Paul's development of the notion of Christian freedom that flows from grace and not from the absence of prohibition. In chapter 6, he startled his hearers by proclaiming, "All things are lawful for me, but though lawful, not necessarily beneficial." In chapter 8, he further spells out this revolutionary idea. Christian freedom does not derive from the absence of prohibition. It flows from the acceptance of responsibility for the impact of one's actions. The sin is not in eating the wrong food. The sin lies in the offense and confusion eating it gives to other members of the same community, who, being younger in faith, are still struggling to internalize the break with their pagan past. The limits placed on freedom come not from the regulation of rules and laws, from prohibitions. The limits on freedom come from our acceptance of shared responsibility, demanding of us an assessment of the impact of our actions on others. So Christian freedom's rule of thumb is not, have I the right to do this thing, but what will the impact be for others if I do so? Can there be no more urgent question in our 21st century ears? It's the burning question that consumes us in America today. Might I also suggest that it's the central question for the Sunday of the annual meeting, when we celebrate our community's achievements in the previous year, and holding this question before us, we prepare to meet the challenges and grasp the opportunities of the year ahead. Amen.